Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, the Premier League is back. Sam Allardyce gives West Brom a fighting chance with a first win at Stamford Bridge for 43 years. There was more bite about the Magpies. Can Newcastle United resurrect their reputation along with their managers? We'll look ahead to the Champions League quarterfinals with some incredible ties on the way, including Real Madrid versus Liverpool. And we'll jump into the most passionate press conferences ever. This all coming on today's episode of the Game Podcast. To help me through it all, Alison Rudd, Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson. Hi guys, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thank you.
Good, nice to hear from you. Hope everyone had a happy Easter as well. The Premier League was back. Lots of people missed it over the international break, but there were some lacklustre performances in there. Certain teams anyway this weekend. It got me thinking about how the international break can really affect a side, because it felt like it killed some teams' momentum, but it was also a welcome break for others. What did you think, Tom?
Well, Southampton clearly enjoyed it. I think Ralf Hasenhüttl looked like a man who'd had a bit of time to think about things. They'd been on a pretty poor run in the Premier League before the comeback win against Burnley, which was a fantastic game. I thoroughly enjoyed it. James Ward-Prowse, as I mentioned before, continues to impress. And Burnley keep proving they're the great entertainers in the Premier League. You want to watch an entertaining game and enjoy your football? Watch a Burnley match. There's some excellent goals. But I thought Southampton looked like a team that had benefited from the break a little bit. Yeah, definitely.
Do you think, Gregor, the biggest teams were most disrupted by the international break? Obviously, a huge amount of their players go off travelling around the world.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's understandable when it's even the kind of mental fatigue of that that amount of travelling and you know another few games in the calendar. I suppose if you look at Liverpool, their kind of Brazilian contingent stayed put. So, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold had a rest, and they were outstanding. So, you know, Chelsea, on the other hand, had to rest a few, and they looked poor. But I don't know. I'm not got that much sympathy personally, because they all have squads big enough to cope with it. And so, yeah, not much sympathy here. I'm sorry.
I was just intrigued, and I guess you did answer the question about how it might affect aside. It never hurt Liverpool, as Gregor points out, Alisson, this weekend. We're going to look ahead to their game against Real Madrid in the Champions League a little bit later, as well as Manchester City against Dortmund and Chelsea's trip to Porto. Chelsea prepared for their game against Porto in the worst possible way, really. Maybe they were, as you mentioned, Gregor, the most affected by the international break. They were beaten 5-2 at home by relegation-threatened West Bromwich Albion. It's Albion's first win at Stamford Bridge since 1978. West Brom, 8 points from safety. Their manager Sam Allardyce said after the match, Albion need 5 wins from the last 8 games to give them a chance. To me, he almost kills their hopes by saying they need to win that many games. You know, why not just say we're taking it a game at a time, Alisson?
Because he was in a very happy place, wasn't he, Hugh? So he's not... If there's a manager who's going to milk as much as possible from a surprise result, it's Sam Allardyce. This has solved all the puzzles of the universe, this result. And in fact, he deserves some credit, doesn't he? Because I think the way Chelsea set up, they were inviting a new form of West Brom to the party, one that could be a bit more adventurous with that back line. I mean, Thiago Silva, he hasn't been in the team for a long time. He is getting on a bit. And it had a very much the... you know, it had a tang of waiting for Porto about it. you know, vintage Porto on Wednesday. That's what it said. And so I think if you're facing a team with that back line, you say to your players, you know, we're younger, we're fitter than a lot of them. You know, we've got something to play for today, not midweek. Go for it. Chase down. Look adventurous. Don't sit back. And that's exactly what they did. And it, you know, obviously I've got hindsight because we know that Thiago Silva couldn't cope and he ended up getting sent off for just having his timing slightly awry. But that was just the most beautiful invitation for a team. They're almost at the point where they've got nothing to lose. You see that every season, really, don't you? That a team dips so far off the running that you think they're going to be quite hard to play against because they've got to the point of no return. But now suddenly, with just one result, there's that sort of shred, little rainbow of hope for West Brom. It's simply because Chelsea said, why don't you have a go? And they did.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point Alison raises. And it links back to your question, Hugh, about pressure. And I wonder whether Allardyce has slightly put the pressure back on to his team. Because when I've watched them recently, it seems to be related to pressure, their performance. They were excellent against Burnley when they went down to 10 men against Burnley. They were fantastic, West Brom. And then they were brilliant against Chelsea, a team that are in form, no one expects them to be. And yet that same kind of verve and enthusiasm and pace and little flicks and tricks and people scoring, the goals were fantastic, weren't they? There were some excellent, excellent goals. But none of that was there in the game against Newcastle just before the international break, the one that was the six-pointer, the one they need to win. None of that was there. And so it is strange. Alison makes a good point, I think, about the pressure being off. And now maybe with, you know, they've got some difficult games, maybe that'll almost help them play better. I mean, you had Pereira proving why I stuck so solidly and, you know, resolutely behind him in my fantasy football team for months on end, only to see him do absolutely nothing, finally showing what he could do. Callum Robinson. I mean, they were brilliant goals, weren't they? Such confidence.
Connor Townsend as well.
Mm. Yeah,
his little flick, you know, when he was running through to have the composure at that moment when Mason Mount was chasing him back to little back heel. Connor Townsend is the one time in my entire career I would not have put myself on the team sheet. He came on loan to Grimsby Town when he was a young lad from Hull City, and he was outstanding. He came for the first half of the season. We were in the conference. It was like my last season in professional football. My legs were going. I had a dodgy knee that was getting injections and stuff. Connor Townsend came in and he was unbelievable. And I remember one game when he got three assists and just thinking, you know, if I was picking the team, I wouldn't play myself. And it was the first time I ever had that kind of revelation. I thought, this doesn't feel good. But he's been brilliant. He's been brilliant under Allardyce particularly. And yeah, some of the goals, sweeping moves, you know. I thought, yeah, brilliant they were.
They've got Leicester, Aston Villa, Arsenal, Liverpool, West Ham and Leeds, amongst others, in terms of their running as well. I mean, that is pressure, Tom.
Absolutely.
That is pressure, exactly, if you need it to perform coming up. But it was an incredible performance from his side. But as you mentioned, Thiago Silva sent off early on and Chelsea just imploded. I mean, that is so different to what we've seen with their sort of calmness, composure under Thomas Tuchel. Hasn't really mattered who's played at the back. They've always seemed to have an element of control. I mean, it just went out the window, and probably that match alone made me wonder how the international break had affected them.
Yeah, I wonder whether there's a bit of a Frank Lampard hangover here, because Lampard's Chelsea always had this in them, didn't they? That was one of our criticisms of them. They weren't reliable. And one of the great things that we've been praising Tuchel for is that he's made Chelsea a bit more reliable. But you don't just switch that off. I think there was an element of, this was the remnants of the Frank Lampard era coming to the surface, perhaps after the international break. I don't actually think it's a terrible thing for Chelsea and for Tuchel to have had this result with a big game coming up, in a way. Because, you know, I wonder whether it'll make him, you know, sort them out a little bit, get it out of the system before the real party happens.
Tom, that's so funny. You've made me think now that every international break, the empty corridors of football training grounds are haunted by previous managers.
What a thought, hey?
Spectres float through the corridors going, ooh, remember me, remember me.
Yeah, what a thought. Don't defend. Don't defend. Don't worry about defending. Just have fun. Attack. Play the kids. It's all right.
We'll talk a little bit more about Chelsea ahead of their game against Porto in the Champions League in our next section of the show. But another team towards the bottom of the table who had an important result, let's call it that, this weekend is Newcastle United. They fought back to earn a point at home to Spurs. They're now 3 points clear of Fulham in the drop zone. But it was their approach that I think might lead to a more positive end of the season. They had 22 shots in the game. Steve Bruce, their manager, said his team had an edge and energy. He said it's time they showed what they were about. Gregor, if Newcastle keep playing like this, do you think they will definitely survive?
Yeah, but it's the chances of them keeping playing like this that's their biggest worry, I think. There were some really good performances. That's what they could take from this. Joe Ellington was kind of, he made a real nuisance of himself, which he often does not. And he's still very, I think there was a chance early in the first half when he drove inside and hit with his left foot. And it looked like, I don't know, an under 12 striking it with his left foot. It's mind boggling, his performances, I think, sometimes for Newcastle. But he is a big presence, and he did make, he backed into players, he held it up and he brought people into play and he worked very hard, so that was encouraging. But as I say, I just think Newcastle have done this before. They've had, they've shown kind of positive performances and then slipped back into kind of really lethargic displays. But the pressure's on now. They really are, although it's in their hands, it's going to be very tight running. So certainly a lot of positive signs for them in this game. And as you say, the chance creation, which is the big thing. I think the expected goals, it was like 4.2 or something to Tottenham about 2. So it wasn't like, they weren't fortunate to get a point here. They had the best chances, and that's been very rare for them this season.
Maybe what we're learning is that after an international break, the struggling teams, if they are more aggressive and do get players in the box and do try and flood forward, that's the point at which you're more likely to get points against a team that's, supposed to be in a top six, going for top four sort of team, because you're getting them when they're at their least defensively well organised. For a whole host of things happen in the international break, don't they? Some players get tired, you lose the rhythm of training. You're more machine-like if you're one of the big teams. So maybe you should maybe the next international break, everyone should analyse what happened, because I don't know if this was on purpose or not, but both West Brom and Newcastle, teams very clearly in trouble, decided to play like teams that were not in trouble against teams that have big ambition. I don't think that can be a coincidence.
They went for it. They absolutely did, Newcastle United. They've got West Ham, Liverpool, Arsenal, Leicester and Manchester City included in their run-in. So they will have to do this a few more times if they're to survive. It was a positive shift, though, for them. And there is a chance, if they do continue to play like this, which is the big question mark, Tom, that the reputation of both the club and the manager, Steve Bruce, could be resurrected over the coming, 8 or 9 games?
I think that's a stretch. I'm sure there'll be a lot of Newcastle fans listening to this going, here they are, classic journalists, not been watching us all season. One decent performance. There's Gregor praising Joe Linton just because he scored one half-decent goal and headed the ball a few times. Bloody typical.
That's more than he's normally done. That's all.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I take your point. There could be an element of revival. I think Newcastle is so steeped in not quite misery yet, but it's heading that way, that I think even if they survive and even if these performances continue, there will still be a lot of rightly unhappy supporters. But it's interesting, you listed those fixtures before, and it's the Burnley factor again. They've got Burnley next. And that's in relation to what I was saying before with West Brom. And Alison and your points about pressure. They've now put in a good performance, shown they can attack, shown they can create chances. They now go to play Burnley, and everyone goes, well, that's a winnable game. That's the winnable game. And do they freeze? That's the question. And I think to your point about the mood, that will be the defining factor, the Burnley performance. Because Burnley are everyone's team that everyone goes, well, you can beat Burnley. Come on, you can beat Burnley. So that'll be the defining factor. But I think it might be a bit of a stretch that even if they survive, that the mood will be completely lifted. I think Bruce will still be under pressure.
You see, Burnley, the team that I always see in the fixture list and go, tough game, always underestimated.
But that's the different thing, isn't it?
People see the word Burnley, they think it's going to be easy, and it's probably one of the toughest games of the season.
Yeah, that's true. But I think, well, at the minute, and Southampton showed that Burnley perhaps aren't quite as solid and Burnley-like as you expect them to be. And so I think in the last few months, Burnley have surprised me a little bit with how easy they are to get at times. So that's why, as a Newcastle fan, if you were the five or six remaining optimistic Newcastle fans out there, we'll be looking at the Burnley fixture and going, come on, we can do this. 3-0 win, then we'll be safe. But we'll see if they flinch or not.
With all due respect, I think I'd rather have James Tarkowski and Ben Mee at the heart of my defence than Davinson Sanchez and Joe Roden at the weekend. It was ridiculous at times. Jose Mourinho was asked why Spurs at the moment, unlike the previous teams he's managed, can't hold on to a lead. He said, it's the same coach, different players. Alisson, is he throwing his players under the bus that they can't park?
He's not going to like any player who can't park a bus, is he? He's throwing them under several lorries actually this weekend, because he said that, and that's not about misunderstanding Mourinho. He's basically saying, I'm an excellent coach, I haven't changed, but I'm in charge of a bunch of Muppets. I think that's a direct translation of that. And he's also pointed out that Alderweireld and Aurier missed their COVID tests, which meant that they couldn't be selected, and implied that, you know, it was their fault, not a club issue. It was down to the individuals just not being organised enough. And, you know, it's like you can sort of visualise him sort of just throwing his hands in the air and saying, you know, how can I possibly cope when I've got this sort of attitude in the team? But he's been there. He hasn't just turned up, has he? This isn't his third week in charge. So at some point, and I don't know what the mathematical formula is, but I think we've reached it. At some point, a team is a reflection of their coach. And if they're not well organised and not turning up for their COVID tests on time, and he can't rejig the team so that they are less porous and can hold on to a lead, then that is down to him. It is down to him. Any manager who's been there that long, he's gone through the get to know them phase, he's gone through the Amazon documentary phase, he's gone through all the phases of becoming a new manager of Spurs, and this team should now be reflecting him. And they're not. And I think one of the most peculiar things about Spurs is that they ebb and flow so dramatically. You know, you can watch them for 15 minutes and think they're absolutely superb, and aren't they blessed to have Harry Kane, and they look good and free-flowing and confident. And then another 15-minute spell, you think they're hesitant and they're not doing the right things, and they're a bit of that don't hold the line properly, and they don't seem to know the system very well, and then they lose the midfield. And then another 50 minutes, oh my God, you know, the midfield's looking really strong and robust, and I really can see an element of what Mourinho's always liked to play as, you know, just strong midfielders ahead of good passes of the ball, just people who can impose their personality. And then another 15 minute comes along and they're another team altogether. That is down to Jose Mourinho. It's not down to anyone else.
His one saving grace could be that if they win the Carabao Cup final, if it's a big if, then he can still be the man who wins trophies, can't he? He had a lot of faults at Manchester United, as I'm sure you remember well, Hugh, but he won trophies. He won trophies for Manchester United. And so he left saying, well, you know, I got second behind a great City team and I won some trophies. And that was the argument for him coming to Tottenham after Pochettino. Oh, it was great football, but ultimately we bottled it, etc. That's a lazy summary of Mauricio Pochettino's time, but you get my point. So if he wins a trophy and finishes seventh, I don't know whether some Tottenham fans might be pleased by that in a way. They've not won a trophy in a long time.
The reality of enduring a season like this and then winning the Carabao Cup, I mean, I think you would sit back after that and go, that's not worth it. We need something more.
I think you're probably right. I'm just merely presenting what Jose Mourinho is now.
Oh yeah, he'll make the most of that, no doubt.
Within modern football, and your points about positive coaches. If he's going to be anything, it's the grumpy guy who wins cup competitions. That can still be a USP, can't it?
Isn't that the life cycle of a manager, though? You come in to the game, you're fresh, you're hungry, you've got new ideas, you're the man for winning league titles. Then your ideas are adopted by other teams, possibly, and it affects your results. You become the man for winning cups and trophies. And then you become the manager for sort of the one-off game. You know, you manage a smaller side. Maybe you go off and do Valencia or Napoli or someone who's not expected to win the league, but you reach the Champions League and everyone says you've done a great job. And then eventually you fall down to being a Europa League manager. And then who knows? You go back to coach your country or your hometown club. I mean, that's sort of how it goes, isn't it?
It could be, but I think Alisson talked before about Sam Allardyce being positive and enjoying a 5-2 win. As Gregor says, there's the misery and the downtrodden and nature of Jose Mourinho's demeanour that doesn't ever seem to change, which is difficult, I think. Because even as you say, Hugh, you're quite right that your place within the game can change over time. But most managers are still enthusiastic about it. It's almost like someone's forcing him to do it. Oh, go on then, I'll take this massive paycheck. Fine.
The biggest thing for me with Jose Mourinho is that it hasn't worked for him. Exactly what he's doing now hasn't worked for him. It hasn't worked at Manchester United. He did exactly the same thing, criticised the players, didn't change his style of football, didn't get the results he wanted. It was a club that people expected to do better. He got sacked. So, you know, he can probably make more money being sacked than working if that's his sort of approach to the game. But the reality of the situation is, I've said this earlier in the year, I expected Tottenham to be the top four. Don't think that's going to happen. But now it's at the point, and they're not the only club in this category, where you just watch their games and say, they should be better. You look at the players they've got, you just go, they should be better. Tottenham Hotspur, even after the international break, maybe that played a part, but the reality is, They shouldn't be drawing 2-2 with Newcastle. They certainly shouldn't be allowing them to have 22 shots. So that's down to the manager. That's down to the organisation. And it doesn't take, for a team like Tottenham Hotspur, who's had 3 days with most of the players, you know, it shouldn't take them a week to be able to defend okay against Newcastle United, and certainly makes Wellington look like he is a £40 million player. But you know what I mean? look, it's now £10 million per Premier League goal, by the way. So Newcastle fans, you do have something to cheer for. It's becoming value for money with that guy. Look, I'll move on from Tottenham Hotspur. We're going to discuss European football next. Of course, nothing to worry about in that regard for Tottenham Hotspur, but we'll discuss the Champions League quarterfinals, some massive matches ahead. Remember though, if you love listening to the game podcast, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times right now as well. If you sign up today, you will get yourself 1 month free. It comes on all of your devices. To boot, just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
well. What a treat in prospect in the Champions League quarterfinals this week. Let's remind you of how that draw came out. It's Bayern Munich against Paris Saint-Germain. What a tie that is. But then three ties involving English clubs, of course. Real Madrid, 13-time winners, taking on Liverpool, going for number 7, of course. Porto against Chelsea and Manchester City versus Borussia Dortmund. Alisson, let's talk about Liverpool. They were back on song at the weekend. They beat Arsenal 3-0. The front three seem a little bit more harmonious. I know some people were surprised. Roberto Firmino started the game, but he sort of proved his worth. Diogo Jota coming off the bench, underlining his importance once again. And even Nathaniel Phillips and Erzan Kabak in centre-half positions, well, they seem to be settling in well together as a pairing. Tom Clark shakes his head. We'll come to his view in a second. Are you happy with how things are with Liverpool at the moment?
Yeah, there's this thing, isn't there, that when it comes to European competition, you're supposed to put aside the team you support and support the team in Europe. And so Arsenal were very kind, making sure that Liverpool go into their Champions League quarterfinal feeling top of the world, because Arsenal did everything they could to pander to Liverpool as the reigning champions. They were fearful of them, and that would have given Klopp's team an awful big boost. Just because I have a theory that it doesn't matter what's happening domestically, that in Europe, Liverpool are feared. They're a feared team. They have a reputation. People take them seriously, no matter what their domestic form might be. And when they've won, the Champions League in recent years, it's not always been because they were the best team in England. There's something special about them. So Arsenal helped to foster that sense that Liverpool are very special team, and that Real Madrid should be scared of them. I mean, you talk about the front three, Hugh. It was when Jota came on that they looked to have that extra spark, that steady. I mean, there's something about him. It's incredible. He just looks like he's going to score. If the ball's within 10 feet of him, you think, oh, he's going to score. And he does. He's just got that. There's absolute spark. It's incredible. And he lifts, and obviously the players know that, and they lift themselves too. Everything just took up another gear when he came on. I don't know why Tom was laughing when you mentioned the defence. I think it's starting to click. There's a moustache at the back now. We didn't have that before. I think that's really important. You can't put a financial value on what having a moustache outside of the transfer window does actually for a team. Normally you think, new signing, but no, there it is. They're looking good. They've been through a dreadful period, Liverpool, and I do genuinely think maybe it's slightly artificial. They know their season's going to be a success or failure based on what happens in Europe, but there seems to be a definite lift to the mood in the camp. And thank you very much, Arsenal, for supporting a fellow English club in Europe.
The reason for my laughter and shaking of the head, and Alison showed her ability as a writer and novelist with that lovely romanticised, poetic take on the game. Arsenal were awful. Arsenal were absolutely crap. That was one of the worst performances I've seen by any team in the Premier League all season. So I've been lured in by an improved Liverpool before this season. I'm not going to let it happen again. They were all right. They were good. But I'm not going to start saying that, the defence looks so much better. I mean, goodness me.
I acknowledged the role Arsenal played. And it's
yes,
funny.
But you did it in such a beautiful, poetic way that you kind of made it seem like it was all part of a master plan. Liverpool were playing an awful, awful team. They were good. They were better. And I think Alisson's moustache could be a defining factor. I remember Petr Cech talking about the ways in which he can put off strikers. I think you might find Karim Benzema running through on goal and suddenly go, wow, my God, that is an impressive moustache, and then forgetting to score. So maybe that'll help. I'm just not falling for the Liverpool comeback again yet. I think it'll be a very, very tough game. Ian Hawkey's been on the podcast before and spoken about Real Madrid and said what a tough team they can be. full of experience, even without Sergio Ramos. I think it'll be a very difficult game for Liverpool.
They are currently unbeaten in 11 games. They've closed the gap at the top of La Liga to 3 points under their boss, Zinedine Zidane. There's no Sergio Ramos playing this week to give Mo Salah nightmares, but it is a huge, huge game, a cracking tie as well. And we talked a little bit about pressure earlier on, Tom. Liverpool might be free of some pressure because Alisson mentioned already, you know, it might be all about the Champions League for them this year.
I think this is the tie that's the most pressured, actually, for both teams, because for Real Madrid, this is the ultimate competition and it looks like they're not going to win La Liga. And for Liverpool, this can be the way that they save their season. So this is arguably the tie with the most pressure. I think perhaps Liverpool are under slightly less pressure, maybe a smidge, than Real Madrid. But I hope it's a entertaining and good game. I have a slight fear that it might be a little dull in a strange way, because I think both teams will feel that pressure and be a bit cautious. I mean, I'd be interested. I don't know whether we talked about Diogo Jota's impact and almost cavalier playing of four forwards. I don't know whether you can do that against Real Madrid in the Champions League. So it'll be interesting to see what side Liverpool select. But I think they're both teams are under a lot of pressure, because this is the be-all and end-all for their season.
I don't think you can start Diogo Jota, to be perfectly honest. It's two legs. The first one's away from home. You've got to try and protect those two at the back as well. You know, it's a huge game for them playing at a level like that. They're going to be taking on Benzema, for example, who's been in good form of late. So I don't expect to see Jota starting, but of course he can have an impact off the bench. Also, I think Firmino will hold the ball up very well. So he's got to, for me, he has to start, although I know you're making the point about all four of them starting. But I almost don't understand why you'd say Real Madrid are under more pressure, because they're second in the league. I mean, they've got a chance of winning the title. Not a bad one, to be perfectly honest. Whereas Liverpool, you know, this could be their way, really, of being in the Champions League next season if they win it. So, Alisson, who's under more pressure?
I think they're both under pressure, but it's different sort of pressure. I don't think we here in England understand quite what it's like to be Real Madrid and not winning, not looking imperious. And especially with Barcelona having a bit of a crisis, are you the Real Madrid faithful will be thinking, what? Why aren't you taking advantage of this? So I think Real Madrid have started to get their act together. They'll be feeling really good about themselves. I think it'll be a really tight two legs, really tight, but not, you know, I wouldn't, I think they're both under pressure, but it's really different sorts of pressure. But I don't think any club's been under the sort of pressure that Liverpool is currently under when a reigning champion has such odd things happen to it. And, you know, so it's been almost embarrassing at times. They both need it enormously. I think you're right, Hugh. I think Liverpool would probably think it might just be their best route to securing Champions League football, and that Real Madrid still can fight on two fronts. But I don't think there's a lot in it. But I think the pressure is so different type of pressure. Liverpool don't have that sort of status, the Galactico status that Real Madrid have, where they're supposed to be something every time. Liverpool are allowed to evolve, whereas Real Madrid is supposed to be at level one the whole time.
I just couldn't believe that it was the first time since October that Liverpool have won three games in a row. That just seems remarkable for a team that are so kind of just wiping the floor with everyone for so long. And it has really been a bizarre season for them. And I agree with Tom. I think I wouldn't say that, you know, that performance was the best we've seen from them in a long while, but I wouldn't say that necessarily we're going to see them steamroll away to their place in the top four in the Champions League final now. I still, you know, there are still weaknesses there, particularly at centre-half.
Let's talk Chelsea next. I know we've already reflected on their game in the Premier League this weekend, but they cannot underestimate Porto after they dismissed Juventus in the last round of the Champions League. They're currently second in the Primeira Liga in Portugal. And Gregor, so many people had Chelsea as their dark horses in this competition. Their first defeat in 15 came at the weekend, as we've discussed. But I wonder whether Chelsea are really as good as their recent record suggests. What do you think?
Well, until the weekend, the answer was yes. I mean, they looked so solid. I think Jorginho and Kovacic on front of that back three looked so solid, and there were like some slapstick moments from those two in the first half, particularly against West Brom. So, and then obviously there's been some reports of kind of little bits sort of pushing and shoving and whatnot in training and fallouts. So it will be interesting to see how they respond. And you know, Tuchel doesn't strike you as someone who pulls any punches in these kind of debriefings. So it will be very interesting to see how they respond. But until this weekend, I would have said yes. I thought, you know, they look so solid, that base. And we know how many kind of options they have going forward. It's just about picking the right players for the right opposition. So I still think Chelsea will come through this, actually. I think they've been impressive.
You see, I'm one of those people who would have said that Chelsea aren't really as good as that recent record suggested, because even though they were hard to score against and clearly hard to beat, they've never really had that free-flowing element of attacking football. They've never scored that many goals either. You know, I think Thomas Tuchel just made them solid, a very solid team. And I think in the Champions League, if you are going to, you know, really challenge, you've got to be a little bit more than that.
I think you're right. I think it's interesting to think about the Champions League, because we were talking after they beat Atletico Madrid, and that was the kind of the pinnacle of the Tuchel era, as short as it's been so far. But that was when everyone started saying, this is what he can do with this team. And then you go and lose to West Brom and you look absolutely awful. And I think I said at the time, it would be interesting if they got a team like Porto, where they would be the favourites. They're the better team. They've got the bigger squad. They've got the more talented players. And so that's why, reflecting back on the West Brom performance, my suggestion that it's not necessarily a bad thing to have that kind of awful performance before this Porto game and have a few kind of rows in training and a bit of a refocus the squad, maybe. I expect them to win, and I think I expect them to put in two good performances over the two legs, and I expect them to win because I just think this will be now, over the next few days, he will refocus, maybe change the team a little bit. Mason Mount will come back in and they'll win, I think.
I haven't seen enough of Porto to really say they're going to be out of it. But the game against Juventus, they certainly showed all the sort of spirit that you would need as an underdog in a tie like this. And I think maybe that will hold them in good stead against the Chelsea, where once again they'll be unfancied, although of course they'll have their striker suspended for the game. I'm interested to see if Thomas Tuchel changes anything as well after that West Brom defeat. You know, will Thiago Silva, who looked rusty, start again? You know, the Champions League isn't really the place for giving away errors. And Andreas Christensen, when he came on, I mean, it was genuinely, I was watching the highlights back a little bit earlier on, it was like someone had won a competition. I mean, he just wasn't marking. Yeah, but he just wasn't marking his man. He was ball watching constantly. I mean, it was like, are you going to check where the striker is at any point in time? You're sort of the last line of defence. Never happened once. He basically wanted to show the striker his number on the back of his shirt. He was doing turns in the box. It was just ridiculous, frankly. It was just ridiculous. You know, a player like that is going to come under pressure in the Champions League. He'll probably have the game of his life and look like Franz Beckenbauer now. But even Kurt Zouma in the game, there was one of the goals, the one that was passed into the bottom corner by Pereira. Chelsea were all over the place. There was actually, at that point, 7 versus 3 in their own box. No one got near the ball. Everyone was running into each other. It was an absolute calamity. And it was so against everything that we'd seen under Thomas Tuchel with Chelsea so far. In fact, he was making most of those defensive players look a lot better than they actually are. And I think, again, maybe it was the international break that made the difference in that game. But certainly they're going to have to sort things out against Porto this weekend. This week, it's going to be interesting anyway. Manchester City, let's talk them next. Their defence looks a lot better, although the Champions League, you know, John Stones in international break as well, you know, maybe it's all unravelling slightly, you never know. Manchester City, Alisson, I think England's best hope. And certainly the way they've played in the league this year. They take on Borussia Dortmund. But I wonder whether Dortmund might be in the mould of Lyon last year in this quarterfinal banana peel type of game, the team that hurts Manchester City most.
I don't think they're England's greatest hope. I've spent the last 30 years discounting City from winning anything in Europe, and I've not been proved wrong yet. So I'm not going to start. If there's, you know, there are truths in life, and City not being able to win the Champions League is one of them, I think. Anyway, I think, honestly, I think we're going to go down the tinkering path again. The mere fact that Pep Guardiola has alluded to it. So after the game against Leicester, he said, you know, when I rotate, I'm a genius if I win. And everyone says, what am I doing if I rotate and we don't win? It's getting into his head already, isn't it? What does he do? What is his best team? And should he do something different because it's the serious stages of the Champions League and everyone thinks they're favourite? And will it get to in? Will it happen? So I think they are probably the nerviest of the English clubs. Compared to what they are normally, in terms of increase in pressure internally, that sort of sense of, come on, why don't we ever do it? And everyone thinks we ought to do it. And Dortmund are not in good form. But then Dortmund have, you know, they can throw everything at this because this is their moment. This is all they've got. So, and they've got great, great players, Dortmund. So you do feel if they click and really want it badly, they could cause an upset. And I do feel clubs do not, are not, because of City's poor record in Europe, clubs abroad don't fear them the way that they're feared domestically. So often you watch City in the Premier League and you look at the opposition and you think, oh, why are you doing that? You know, you're not normally like that. You're being a bit cautious. Why don't you push on? I've seen you, you know, in similar situations, be a bit more adventurous. You're clearly scared of what Manchester City can do to you on the break. I don't think in Europe, for all the watching and analysis they'll do, there just isn't that sense of fear about what City can do to you. It's, you know, it just isn't there. They don't have the aura they have. They have a huge aura in the Premier League. And they don't have it abroad. If I was Dortmund, playing for Dortmund, managing Dortmund, anything to do with Dortmund, I would be thinking, why can't we dominate the tactics? Why can't we be the team that is expected to win this game? So I don't think there are England's best chance of progress in the competition at all.
There you go. I think
the runaway Premier League leaders, yeah, England's worst chance in the, yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, the main difference in the Champions League for them this season is too is how much better their defence is. They're not relying on Otamendi at the back. You know, they look solid, and, you know, or Fernandinho is not, they're not losing him from midfield because he has to play centre half. They look like a well-oiled machine just now. And I absolutely think they're the best chance. Sorry, Alison. I think, you know, I don't know, maybe something as well about there not being fans there. It's just like pure football now, isn't it? And when it's that, then Manchester City are the best at the moment, undoubtedly. I'd make them favourites for the competition, in fact. If Lewandowski's not fit for Bayern Munich, I'd make them favourites for the competition just now.
Well, I think those two opinions have allowed me to sit firmly on the fence. We've got. I'm just going to say, who knows? Who knows? One interesting point that Alison made about the tinkering and Pep in these big games, and I think it's obviously been a problem for him in the past, and Hugh, you've brought it up on podcast previously, but I do wonder whether this current squad is more suited to tinkering than his previous squads, and the players, particularly in forward and midfield areas, a bit more adaptable. We saw, if you reflect back on that Chelsea performance, the win against Chelsea, which was the start of, everyone realising, wow, this City team are really something this season. That was some enforced tinkering, wasn't it? With no one really playing as striker, De Bruyne playing as a false nine. So I wonder whether he's fine-tuned his tinkering to the point where now he can make some changes, and it won't be detrimental. So I think, Alison, you could be right that we could see something a bit different from Pep, but whether it might be, as he said in his press conference, the genius moment rather than, as Hugh, you've been worried about, a moment where it all falls apart once again.
If I see three at the back when that Manchester City team sheet comes out, I'm going to be absolutely livid, and that's as a Manchester United fan. He overthinks it too much. I mean, for me, I agree with Gregor. I'd say Bayern Munich are the favourites. Without Lewandowski, Manchester City are the favourites. I think they are England's best chance. The squad's irresistible at the moment. Kevin De Bruyne just about coming back towards his full fitness as well, and definitely getting his rhythm back in terms of being in that starting 11 makes a huge difference. A player of that quality needs to win the Champions League at some point, I think.
He's the only player too that really you would think if they lost him, it would be an enormous dent. You could say the same about Diaz, but Stones' re-emergence, they're okay there. You look at their bench, at Stones, Silva, Cancelo, Gundogan, Sterling was on the bench, Foden was on the bench. That's a ridiculous squad. So there's not really an area, and as Tom says, it was in the past, Aguero, if he drops out, if he's injured, then who's the backup? They've found a solution to that this season. So, if De Bruyne is fit, the rest of the squad is almost interchangeable.
Does anyone think that Erling Haaland is going to be the difference in this tie? Do you think Manchester City's defence are about to face something that they haven't seen before?
It's going to be interesting because this will probably be the first time a lot of English football fans will have watched him for a full 90 minutes. He's the ultimate modern footballer. The highlights reels, the social media clips, everyone who's never even watched him for more than 10 minutes. And this is not a criticism of these views, because the goals are so spectacular that they allow you to say, wow, this guy is clearly an amazing player. But this is our chance to see his all-round game and see whether he does work hard off the ball and all these things that we talk about in modern football. So I'm fascinated to see that and how he performs in a big game against a very good defence. Because he's clearly a player who likes the big occasion. I think Gregor talked about it with the last round when they beat Sevilla, with the kind of joking and winding up the opposition and things. So I'm sure he will be very, very much up for it and trying to cause an upset. But it will be interesting to see, alongside the spectacular goals, what else are his real strong points and things. I'm fascinated. I don't know whether he'll do it.
The question is, are City's defenders facing something different? And the answer is yes. he is definitely something different. But look, City have been brilliant defensively, so whether he can have quite the same impact would be fascinating to see. Slightly disappointed too, some reports about Jadon Sancho perhaps being injured, missing the game. So, it's always good to see him go back and kind of playing against his former team, showing them what they're missing, maybe.
Did anyone believe Pep Guardiola when he said Manchester City don't have the money to buy a striker this summer, even though they've already announced that Sergio Aguero is going to be leaving?
No, God, don't you know them? I know them. I know people who have the biggest houses and second homes and go skiing every year. But they really, really want to portray themselves as being like you and me. So they'll say, I don't think I can go for a drink. I'm sort of trying to save a bit of money this month. Well, they stood in front of their £8.5 million mansion. There are people like that who don't revel in their, they don't want to revel publicly in their wealth and their privilege. They want to feel like they're just normal. They're just normal people who have to worry about the cost of a pint of milk. It's absolute rubbish, but it's part of a personality trait that you want to be not seen as too elite and operating in a rarefied atmosphere, because it doesn't reflect well on his ability, does it? If his legacy is that he only managed teams with lots of dosh and could buy who he wanted when he wanted, I don't think he wants that legacy. So that's why he says things like that.
And he said that after watching his starting 11 that cost, I think, a Johnny Northcroft's report, £530 million or something like that. So
that is the ski lodge in the
it's
background.
It's laughable. Laughable stuff.
The thing is, if Erling Haaland's going to be £150 million, then it would still be way above what Manchester City have spent in the past. And a little dig from Pep Guardiola ahead of this game as well. He says Borussia Dortmund have done so well to bring in loads of these young players, but they do pay a fair whacking agent fees. And he made that point, to bring in all of these great young talents. And if news reports are to be believed, it's going to be a hell of an agent fee to both Mino Raiola and Alfinger Haaland, Haaland's dad, who represents him as well, if you're going to get his signature this summer. €20 million each is in one report this summer.
But well worth it for Dortmund if they're turning around in 1 year. A player that they bought, what did they buy him for, £20 million?
Mm-hmm. Not much more than that, yeah.
Yeah, and 12 months later, they've got the biggest kind of wrestling match for a player that you can remember in kind of the last decade. Yeah, I think paying, it's not, you know, no one likes to see agents taking whopping fees like that, but that one was worth it.
I like the idea of Pep being so affronted by this podcast and Alisson's suggestions that they're not good enough to win Europe and that he's got so much money that instead of Haaland, he goes out and buys Dominic Calvert-Lewin or something. The two, to be honest, would probably cost upwards of 70 million anyway. But just to make the point, I don't need Haaland and I can't afford him. So instead, I'm going to scrape the pennies together instead.
I think it was silly. I'm getting tired of Pep Guardiola saying stuff like this, to be perfectly honest. Although, after the weekend, and I, you know, there was a discussion on Match of the Day about Harry Kane's future. And some people saying that Manchester City could be going in for Kane. Tom Clark, if they're going to spend a little bit less, possibly 30 million quid less, 120 million quid on someone like Harry Kane, would they do that?
There again, it's proof they listen to the Game podcast, because we discussed this a few weeks and months ago. And I said, Pep, he's only got a couple of years left at City. Just pay the money for Harry Kane, win the lot and leave. Happy days. Take that, Alisson Rudd. Told you I could win it in Europe. See you later.
It was a Copa del Rey final this weekend. It was a Basque derby. Real Sociedad beating Athletic Bilbao. And then Imanol Aguacil, the manager of Sociedad, came into his press conference post-match. He put on a club shirt, he held a club scarf aloft, and he began to chant as if he was on the terraces. It was a sight to behold, apparently in appreciation for all of those who had watched the game. He used to play for the club for 8 years as well. And it got us thinking about the most passionate press conferences we can remember. It was very impassioned. You should see it, by the way. Check it out on YouTube or wherever. Tom Clark, I'm going to start with you. Do you remember the most passionate press conferences?
Mine that spring to mind aren't necessarily passionate in the same way, definitely not in the most positive way. I mean, there's a Roy Hodgson one of him being interviewed after a match, I think as West Brom manager, and the outtake of the exchange where he gets asked a question that he doesn't like and then, you know, starts swearing and gets very, very upset. And very unlike Roy Hodgson, the character that we know, and he seems very mild-mannered and intelligent man, gets very, very offended by being asked a question about, oh, what decision were you unhappy with? What do you mean? You know what decision? What stupid bloody question. Anyway, let's start again. And then gets asked the question, vaguely similar question. You just asked me that, but we've started again. And it's very, very uncomfortable, but it's excellent to watch. And the other one that sprung to mind was Harry Redknapp, which is not a press conference again, but I'm cheating a little bit. But the great interview where he's being interviewed at the training ground. I'm not sure whether it's West Ham or Portsmouth, but this is just absolutely superb. And there's some players kicking a ball in the background and one of them flies past and nearly hits him, spins around. What the F are you doing? And then the reporter tries to maintain professionalism and say, okay, blimmin' heck, that was a bit close, Harry. Anyway, I'll ask you a question. And he asks him another question. You can see Redknapp in his eyes is still furious. And he's like, I'm not finished. Turns around and goes, no wonder he's in the effing reserves. It's so good. So good. So
yeah, I think
good.
One of the players, he says, what are you playing at? And someone says, you're just shooting, gaffer. And he says, shooting? Yeah. You know, the goal's miles
away. You hit me over here. Oh, it's fantastic. Fantastic. But I would just like to wait one, press conference-wise, and these segments of the show tend to turn into Tom's tips for what to watch during lockdown. But I did have some positive responses to my suggestions about Fernando Redondo highlights reels. If you have some time to kill whilst we're awaiting life returning to normal, I recommend the Mick McCarthy 5-year montage highlights reel on YouTube from his time at Wolves. It's basically just the outtakes in between questions, and it is absolutely superb. It's just him sitting there kind of, oh, fig off, do me a cheesy quaver. Anyway, I were vanishing my shed at 6 a.m. And there's a great still. Whoever's edited it has done it brilliantly as well, because he intersplices it with bits of Mick stirring his coffee. It's fantastic. It's a joyous, joyous 5 minutes in a very different way to the Sociedad manager. So there you are. There's Tom's tip.
He's not changed at all either. I did one, a Mick McCarthy press conference when he came back to Cardiff, and he's just the same, like, the gruff old Yorkshireman. Like, I love him, though. Great to have him back.
It's brilliant, a brilliant value. That's my advice on how to spend your 5 minutes at some point this week.
Alison?
Well, I loved about that Sociedad press conference was that it was so stage managed, and that you had the press officer handing him his shirt. And then he put his shirt on. And then the press also handed him his scarf. So he put his scarf on. And I just felt it might have been a bit better if he'd had a little carrier bag on the desk and then done it all by himself. But it just made me think, you know, sometimes managers come out and they know what they're going to do and it's prepared. So it doesn't matter, almost doesn't matter what has happened in the game. They will know what they want to say. And, you know, Rafa's piece of paper and facts is the most famous, but a less famous one was involving me. So I'm going to talk about the one involving me, which was in May 2007. Stevie Highway, who had huge success with Liverpool Academy, decided to leave the club and no one knew why. And I went and spent the day with him at the academy, and I wasn't really expecting him to tell me why he was leaving. You know, he said he was leaving because Rafa Benitez, although he was a good manager, didn't understand youth football and he just couldn't stay any longer. And Steve Highway's a huge hero of mine. So I said, are you sure you want to say that? And he said, yeah, no, Rafa doesn't understand youth football. Are you sure you want to say that? Yeah, no, he doesn't understand youth football. So I wrote a huge piece saying Steve Highway, Liverpool legend, is leaving Liverpool because Rafa Benitez doesn't understand youth football. Anyway, the game before, one of the games before the Champions League final, Rafa's Liverpool are at Fulham. I'm covering the game. Liverpool lose 1-0. Press conference afterwards. I'm sort of near the back of the room. People are asking normal questions like, oh, Rafa, you know, were you resting people for the Champions League? Rafa just says, apparently, I know nothing about youth football. And everyone in the room is looking at each other, going, what's going on? And then someone asks another question about the match. And he goes, apparently, I know nothing about youth football. And so I look at the press officer and give him that sort of wide-eyed, what's going on look, and he shrugs at me like, I don't know what's going on. So I just sort of slowly sink into my chair. Not everybody in the room had read the Times that day, bizarrely, and they didn't know what the hell was going on, but he answered every question almost with, oh, apparently I know nothing about youth football. But it was just clearly it got to him and he wanted to say it in the press conference. And I think we forget sometimes that is a moment of power, isn't it, for any manager? And I'm surprised more of them don't do something like that. They put on the shirt and wave a flag or bring out sandwiches or show some photographs of their grandchildren. I mean, it's a moment of power. So all credit to him for doing something different anyway.
Gregor, come on, someone must have blasted you in a post-match press conference.
Blasted me? No, the first one that came to my mind was Jim McLeod. It was much like Roy Hodgson's, in that a reporter had asked a question that I think he probably promised not to. And Jim McLean, former Dundee United chairman, this is quite famous, he got extremely angry and sweary. And then it, in fact, boiled over to a physical assault. So going a bit further than passion. He went a bit too far, but that has gone down in legend in Scotland. Jim McLean was a man you did not mess with. But more recently, Charlie Austin in 2018, I don't know if you remember, after I think he'd had a goal ruled out against Watford. I think he drew 1-1.
Oh, yeah.
And he just, the thing that was hilarious about it was his kind of voice went up in his life. It's ridiculous. It's a joke. It's like, it was like for like a minute and a half, no matter what the interviewer was asking him, he's going, yeah, but we should have won the game. We should have won. This little high-pitched voice. And then I think about exactly 1.5 minutes in, he sort of realised that he was squealing and shouting and then sort of dipped back into professional mode going, yeah, it's disappointing. But so Charlie Austin.
He was up to about 2 weeks' wages and 3 games ban in terms of what he'd already said.
He had
said.
This sort of disconcerting bloodshot eye at the same time as well while he was sort of staring at the interviewer. So, yeah, Charlie Austin.
My favourite's not even in English. Giovanni Trapattoni at Bayern Munich, if you've never seen it. They've lost 1-0 to Schalke. They are second in the league. A couple of players have come out in the media, Mario Basler and Mehmet Scholl, critical that they weren't in the starting 11. Thomas Strunz objected to being substituted as well. And a minute into his press conference, Giovanni Trapattoni, it builds. And he suddenly says, in this game, two or three or four players were weak like an empty bottle. And he slams the desk with his hand as well. And I absolutely love this because it's not quite what Jose Mourinho's done at the moment, but it's pretty much what every single manager wants to do as well. He says Thomas Strunz, but he elongates it. So it sounds like he's basically insulting him in Italian with his own name. So he pronounces it as an Italian insult, but actually he just says, oh no, I was angry. Just said his name like that. But basically he says he's been here for 2 years, he's played 10 games, he's always injured. What right does he have to say anything, basically, about one of his own players? And I absolutely love that a manager would just say, look, you're never even fit, frankly. You haven't got a right to say anything in front of all the media, and then basically storms out after 2 minutes. But if you've never seen that, honestly, you've got to. He is absolutely livid. I mean, there's quite a few, let's be honest. We don't get to see that much passion.
We have to mention Joe Kinnear as well, surely. So some of his. And Joe Kinnear was a manager I had at Forest. So he's just come to mind, actually, yeah. He called the Forest fans morons once after. And he got sacked very soon afterwards. But he was something else, Joe Kinnear. And then do you remember he called Charles Nzogbia insomnia? And he went in the huff. But he used to call me George. So and he called players all sorts of names. It wasn't like intentional. So and obviously Joe Kinnear had that expletive laden rant as well at all the local journalists one time. So Joe Kinnear's right up there, yeah.
And George is your new nickname on the game podcast. Thanks for revealing that small tidbit. I'll be using that one. Love these little pieces of information. Alison Rudd, Tom Clark, George Robertson, thank you for being with me for the past hour or so, and to all of you for listening as well. We'll be back on Thursday. We'll be looking back at some fantastic games in the Champions League, I am sure. But remember, if you want more of our great journalism from the Times and the Sunday Times, you can subscribe across all of your devices. If you sign up today, you'll get 1 month free. Just search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. We will see you on Thursday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.